I want to talk about this. And I emphasize it's a review of old results. So all of the, I used to work in this problem 10 to 15 years ago, and I haven't worked on it since, okay? But over many dinners in cheap restaurants in Isla Vista, Jason convinced me that I have to give this talk, so I had no choice. Okay, and also I should apologize to the participants that I have really not followed the very beautiful developments in the cold atom fields, except for reading the abstracts of the experimental papers which claim to see this. So,
well, many of us apologize that we have not followed some of the details.
Okay, so that's, with that out of the way, let me just go and tell you some things. So in outline, what I want to do is I want to talk about the 3D dilute gas, which is probably the most relevant to the cold atom people. Then I want to talk about two dimensions, because there are some interesting features there which people may not be aware of. And finally, I want to say a few words on breakdown of Fermi liquid theory, because actually that is what motivated me many, many years ago to look at this problem. Very roughly, my motivation was the following, that if you take an attractive Fermi system, it goes from a system of fermions to a system of bosons, and then question is, in the intermediate regime, does it look somehow weird, okay? And of course, this question, at least I will try to give an answer as we reached about 10, 15 years ago to this question. Okay, so let's first start with the 3D Fermi gas. Now here I actually suspect that what is known to people in many body physics rather well is probably not known to the cold atom community and vice versa. So I don't want to spend a lot of time, but let's say we have some Fermi gas in the continuum, mass 2m, Fermi energy epsilon f, which is determined by the density n, okay? And let's further say that one has some two-body interaction. And for the sake of definiteness, I'm going to write down a finite range potential. Actually, there's some power law faster than something or the other, which is perfectly fine. And I'm going to look at the dilute regime. And the dilute regime is that the range of the potential is much less than the average spacing between particles. Okay, so KFR is always going to be a small parameter for me, right? Now, in this limit, one can actually get some results which are independent of the detailed shape of the potential. Okay, and as is very well known, basically, you have to characterize the interaction by the low energy properties of the T matrix. Now, I'm just discussing the two-body problem in vacuum, as it were. Okay. Why T matrix? Well, one, it gives you answers in terms of phase shifts, which are independent of the detailed shapes of the potentials. And particularly, if your potential does have hard cores or short distances, then one really needs to have a T matrix to describe the interaction, okay? A Born approximation fails miserably. So the T matrix in the limit in which KR much, much less than 1, K prime R much, much less than 1, which comes from the diluteness condition, and zero energy is basically some number times the scattering length. So this is the all-important parameter, which is probably extremely well known to people in your community. But just to get my notation straight, let me give an example, not the notation, rather the idea is actually straight. So suppose I take some specific case of a hard core plus square well potential, which has a depth v naught, then as a function of the depth of this potential v naught, what does the scattering length do, so that we have some idea about the physics of the problem. So I will write down the scattering length divided by the range of the potential. And of course, if the attraction is zero, it's a hard sphere. Suppose this is alpha r. This is some number of order unity. It's just a hard sphere radius. Okay? And then, as I crank up the attraction, this goes down, eventually diverging to negative infinity and coming out on the positive infinity side here. Okay? So that's the picture. So there are two characteristic depths here. Let me call them V sub A and V sub B. So in this region, where the scattering length is positive, the phase shift actually is negative, because it's a repulsive potential and the wave function is pushed out. And in fact, you can almost think of the scattering length right here as just the hardcore radius, if you want. Okay, so this is an essentially repulsive Fermi gas, and we will not discuss this. Okay, once you cross this threshold where the scattering length becomes negative, basically what you find is that although the phase shift at zero energy is zero, which means there's no bound state in the two-body problem in vacuum, the phase shift at finite energies is actually positive. So in other words, you get attraction if you are looking away from zero energies, and that's why this is the threshold for a BCS instability. Okay? And then, as you crank up the attraction more and more, the scattering length becomes more and more negative, eventually diverging. And at this point, okay, this becomes the threshold. So this BCS instability is in the many-body problem. As I said, there is no two-body bound state. Okay? So once you cross VB, you get the threshold for two-body bound state formation in vacuum. Okay? So in other words, beyond here, this is positive. In fact, this is equal to just n pi by Levinson's theorem, where n is 1. This modulo pi counts the number of bound states that you have. Okay. So we will be interested in potentials in this region, and not at least in this calculation. Of course, if you keep on cranking this up, you can get more and more bound states. We're not going to worry about that. We're just going to worry about this range of parameters. And it's also useful to note that once a two-body bound state exists in vacuum, then in fact, this is the size of that bound state, AS. Okay? So it has a very physical meaning once it's positive on this side. Okay, so that just sets the stage for the two-body problem in vacuum. And now we want to understand what the fate of the many-body problem is. We certainly know what happens here, BCS theory, but as we make the attraction stronger and stronger, what happens? That's the question. Okay, so, well, you have to find some way to solve that many-body problem, and there are many different ways to do it. Perhaps one convenient way to do it is to use functional integrals. Now, I think I'm not, yes, certainly.
So it's not quite like just tuning a potential, right? I mean, at this VB.
Yes.
There should be some kind of qualitative change. Do I get it right?
No, I'm simply tuning a potential. Yeah. And right now, if you ignore this one comment here, okay, everything that I've said is just a statement about the two-body problem in vacuum, and this is the threshold for the formation of bound states. That's all.
Yes. So in the many-particle system,
yes,
there's also a Fermi energy.
Yeah, so we will come to that.
That's all coming
later. That is all coming later. Okay, this just sets the stage for what the interaction is. Okay, so now I don't particularly want to go through the functional integral, right? Because I assume the experts know it, and those who don't will probably not find a, two-minute summary particularly illuminating. Is that a fair statement? I mean, anybody who has questions can definitely talk to me if you want. But in outline, basically what you do is, you write down the partition function of the interacting many-body system as a coherent state path integral, and you get to do a functional integral over the Fermi fields. Since there are very few fermion integrals that we can do, one, the Gaussian, you integrate out the fermions at the earliest stage possible, and then you get an effective bosonic action. Now, for those of you who know this, you basically use the Hubbard-Stratonovich trick to decouple the attractive interaction. Okay? And then, basically you just, the first thing you do in a functional integral is to look at a saddle point approximation, which is sort of like doing some mean field theory. And actually, one just looks at saddle points where this Hubbard-Stratonovich field, which in general is a space-time dependent function, is, so you're looking really at a uniform static pairing field, as it were, okay? And the saddle point is defined by saying that the effective action is minimized over this class of uniform static saddle points, and this gives you the gap equation. Okay, so I will just write it down and then just explain it a bit. Okay, and so M is the mass, A is the scattering length, epsilon K is just the dispersion, K squared over 2M, and EK is epsilon squared minus mu. Yes. Okay, and this is one equation we have, and there are two unknowns in the problem. One is delta naught, and the other is mu. I will come to how to fix second equation in a second. So, but for this, this just is the same as the BCS sort of gap equation. And all that has happened is that you need to, see, in BCS gap equations, you get this VKK prime, which is more familiar in textbooks and so on. And I said that VKK prime is not even well defined, the Fourier transform of this, okay? So somehow you have to regularize that. And the physical picture is simply that in a many-body system, when two fermions get close together, basically you can use information about the two-body problem in vacuum to regularize that ultraviolet divergence. And that's exactly what I've done. And so that VKK prime gets replaced by a T matrix, and this is how it enters. And this takes care of the ultraviolet divergence, okay? So that's the...
This is the dimension I'm just using this. So M is mass in kilograms.
Yeah, there's some volume factors, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
See, because if you remember here, VKK prime is the unit volume, as always, okay? And H bar can be one. See, this, look at this. This is the Fourier transform of a potential, basically. So it's volume times energy, okay? And this, as you can see, is actually volume times energy, because I can put two factors of length downstairs and two upstairs.
H-bar, so
yeah, I'm probably missing.
There, there's
volume.
Okay,
good. And then the next question is how to fix the chemical potential, and you use thermodynamics. and I'm going very slowly, so let me speed up. Okay, and so what do I use for the grand potential omega naught? Well, I just, at the saddle point level, it's just this, because, you know, I said that the partition function is defined in terms of this effective action. Okay, and so when you crank through this, you get a very simple equation, which is also very familiar. It's just to BCS efficient under, this is 2 times Vk squared. So these are all very standard equations. Beta, by the way, is the inverse temperature. Okay, very good. Now, you can solve these two equations simultaneously. And at zero temperature, they were effectively solved in, or at least some variant of this was solved by David Eagles in 1969, and then revived by Tony Leggett in a very beautiful paper in 1980. Okay, so this is old stuff.
Why did David Eagle think of?
Yeah, he was thinking about strontium titanate. So it's a very low density system in which you might get superconductivity. Okay, and so he was thinking about this in a paper which has not gotten much attention, but he has these kinds of ideas very clearly stated in there. Okay, so then you can write, you can actually analytically solve them in two limits. And it turns out that the BCS limit is the limit where 1 over KFAS goes to minus infinity. Because remember, in the BCS limit, AS is negative and very small. Because you've just crossed this threshold. And therefore, 1 over KFAS goes to minus infinity. And the Bose limit is where AS is positive and is now becoming quite small. And so this is the limit 1 over KFAS going to plus infinity. So I'm going to show you some results, which are, so maybe one could write down some analytic expressions. That, so at zero temperature, you can really solve this analytically. So this just becomes the Fermi energy and the gap becomes some number times the Fermi energy and is exponentially small in the interaction. So it's got the usual essential singularity that you know and love in BCS theory. On the other hand, in this other extreme limit, the chemical potential just becomes minus 1/2 the binding energy with a calculable correction. So the binding energy, remember I'm out here, I have a two-body bound state in vacuum whose size is 1 over AS, and there's some mass has some factors of 2 in it, but we won't worry about that, and H bar is 1, so that's what the binding energy is. And this is a very sensible result because the energy to put in a single particle is 1/2 the energy to break a pair, and you can also work out what the order parameter in this limit is. We will come to spectral gaps and so on in a second. And this is some number times KFAS, et cetera, et cetera. So let me show you the first transparency. And let's turn off the lights. So what do we want to see from here? So here you can see delta over epsilon Fermi as a function of 1 over KFAS. This is the BCS limit going to minus infinity. That is the Bose limit. And this is the chemical potential. And as you can see, actually, that this crossover is rather sharp and is just restricted to 1 over KFAS between minus 1 and plus 1. Outside of that, these dashed lines are basically the asymptotic results that you can just work out analytically, and the numerics just smoothly interpolates between them insofar as both of these are concerned. Okay, another thing to note is that at some point, the chemical potential goes below the bottom of the band, which in this case is 0. And together with that, you can see that the momentum distribution is becoming essentially non-degenerate, which means that the Fermi occupancy as a function of increasing attraction eventually becomes such that at all k's, n of k is much smaller than 1. Okay? So this is zero temperature, the attraction is undoing the Fermi C. But this doesn't happen immediately. Okay? In the BCS limit, of course, is just a very slightly broadened step. What else do I want to say? Second thing I want to say is here are some length scales. And the only length scale that we can really define at zero temperature is this dashed object, which is the pair size. And that's just given by h bar vf over delta in the BCS limit. But eventually, it becomes just 1 over a, it becomes just as, because I told you that's the size of the bound state. So the pairs become smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller as you tune through this crossover. This other length scale will show up in a second. That's the prefactor of the Ginzburg-Landau correlation length. Okay, so the Ginzburg-Landau correlation length is something that diverges at TC, but it has a prefactor. And that prefactor turns out to be essentially the same as the size of the pairs in the BCS limit. It then falls down to a value which is of order KF inverse, meaning the interparticle spacing. But then it rises again. And we understand how this rises because, as you know, in this limit, one is going to a dilute Bose gas. And in a dilute Bose gas, the healing length is not the interparticle spacing, but is larger because of the diluteness parameter. And you see that coming out.
Actually, the minimum is not actually at resonance on the BEC side a little bit.
I don't really know whether you should trust these fine details of such a calculation. Because as we will discuss in a second, okay, so I mean, this calculation at zero temperature could have been done even as a variational calculation. And the reason why we think it's reasonable is because it gets to quite non-trivial limits and in between has variational significance. But whether if you were to do some more elaborate calculation, whether things would shift a little bit quantitatively in the intermediate coupling regime, there's no small parameter that really controls this calculation right here. And we will return to that fact. Okay? Now,
Yeah, I think it's precisely because there's no parameter, no small parameter, and in some way this is variational. So somehow the variational calculation is also to be a universal value for that minimum. I understand one should not attach too much meaning of it, but the question is whether the minimum.
I think the minimum is a robust thing because but its precise location. And that the minimum value of that should be at the order of the interparticle spacing is also a robust thing. Okay, so the next thing we want to discuss is the excitations at zero temperature. So let's first discuss one particle excitations. And this is given by the usual Bogliubov formula. And there is a slight twist on it, that so long as the chemical potential is above the bottom of the band, then the picture of Ek versus epsilon k indeed looks like this. And the gap, which is the minimum, indeed is delta naught. Okay? But once the chemical potential crosses the bottom of the band, which it does at sufficiently strong attractive interactions, then this picture, where Ek equals mu has this minimum here, you find looks like this. So mu is negative. Okay? But the excitation energy, the gap, should be the minimum of this function over epsilon k positive. And so the gap no longer sits at epsilon k equals mu, but rather at epsilon k equals 0. And therefore, the gap turns out to be mod mu squared plus delta squared. Okay, and this actually seems like a sort of small quantitative change, at least in this problem. But if you were ever to deal with a situation where the pairs had some internal structure, and in particular in the BCS limit, the gap would have had nodes, then when the chemical potential goes below the bottom of the band, this kind of idea leads to the fact that you have no nodes, even though the pair wave function has this non-trivial internal structure. And roughly speaking, it's like saying, at least in the extreme Bose limit, it's very easy to understand, that even if my molecule had some internal structure, the gap is just the dissociation energy of breaking apart the pair. It doesn't have any structure in momentum space. And in fact, basically in that extreme limit, mod mu dominates over delta, and so you just get this answer for the gap. Gap is 1/2 the pair binding energy.
I'm studying that would have significance in a case you're dealing with a pairing state that has nodes.
This is correct.
So in this context, then it may not be as surprising. But on the other hand, you say in a D or higher wave, then
a P?
Then it would be.
Yeah, it's something to be something to keep at the back of one's mind. Whether it's important or not, I don't know. In any specific context, you'd have to look at it.
Another question.
Yes.
Somehow, I guess a bit contentious, and I don't know what the final answer was. The point where the nodes lift off the Fermi surface.
Yes.
I guess the free energy is smooth, right? It's not.
No, actually, there will be a there will be some singularity in the ground state energy as a function of parameters when the chemical potential goes below the bottom of the band.
Is that speculation or fact?
Okay. Fact means there's no exact solution. Okay. So this is some. The assumptions of the calculation in this intermediate coupling regime where this is going to happen, I have already laid out to you. But I think physically it seems very plausible that indeed that's what will happen.
Why?
Why? Because
there's no symmetry change. Why should the symmetry for energy know about in those?
Okay, the spectrum changes in some
so
way.
What?
Yeah, we can get into that discussion. Yeah. But I think I prefer not to.
For the time.
Yeah. Okay, so then when one looks at collective excitations, that also one can look at in this functional integral framework. Yes.
Slow down a little bit.
Yes.
The singularity.
Yes.
It's a singularity. It's a function of what? A function of the potential.
Yes. Or coupling constant.
Oh, no.
So or chemical potential, if you want.
So then there is a thermodynamic singularity. Then may not be of the usual kind, but then there is a singularity.
Yes.
Okay.
So one can actually study the collective excitations by, you know, expanding. This and looking at fluctuations and so on and so forth. And this has been studied in great detail. And
sorry, can I just ask you a question about that diagram?
There? Sure.
First of all, about the wave functions. Do the particles become more and more particle-like as you head towards the BEC limit?
Would you want to?
Well, you know, it's the U and the V. It's whether they become more and more unhole-like and more particle-like as the chemical potential extends. Uh-huh.
Have to think about that.
Okay, the other question.
Yes.
The way you drew it,
yes.
Does it imply that the excitation spectrum is linear at small k?
Yes, it would look like.
So the things look sort of massless, do they?
But there's a gap.
There's a gap, but then as a function of k above the gap, it's sort of like
That is certainly what this calculation would give you. That's right, because you know it's basically just asymptoting to epsilon k, and you're.
No, wouldn't it be like k squared? I mean, if you expand the
distance, here?
Epsilon k is small.
Here? He's asking here.
Yes, yes. But if we just expand the BCS expression.
Oh yes, not the BCS expression. He's asking
in this limit,
not here.
Oh, I know, but
I think there's an epsilon k is small.
Finite first goes linearly into epsilon k.
That's
so which goes like k squared. I mean.
Good.
Plotting it as a function of epsilon k.
Yeah.
So it's going by k squared.
Yeah. Okay. Which is fine. Okay. Collective excitations. Well, so, okay, in view of the time, let me just speed up here, okay, so that we can get to more interesting things. Yes?
Fine.
Yeah? Okay. So basically, in the BCS limit, you find that the amplitude mode is gapped. It sits at 2 delta naught. You find that the phase mode, this is a neutral system, okay, a charge neutral system. So the phase mode is the usual Anderson-Bogliova mode, and you can calculate its dispersion and so on and so forth. And then you can follow how that evolves all the way into the bosonic regime, excuse me, and you can then calculate the phase, the amplitude phase, and the amplitude-amplitude correlation functions, okay, as a function of Q and omega. And what you find is something, of course, which is well known in the Bose literature, namely that all those three correlations have the Bogliubov pole, but only the phase-phase correlator has a residue that is finite in the Q going to zero, omega going to zero limit. The other, meaning the amplitude-amplitude and the amplitude-phase modes, have residues that vanish as you go into the long wavelength low-energy limit. Okay, and from that you learn, actually, you just get the Bogliubov sound mode for bosons. So BCS I describe in the BEC limit. Maybe it's worth writing down what the thing is. So there are all kinds of very detailed expressions and so on and so forth. The reason for just putting some of this down is simply to say that it's not just a matter of words. It turns out from the calculation that you really get bosons with a mass of 2m and with a speed of sound such that the bosons are actually interacting with each other and so on and so forth from this calculation. Okay. So now let me turn to the problem of, right now I've stuck to zero temperature, so now let's go to finite temperatures, because then things already begin to look a little bit different and slightly interesting. Okay, so we found that at T much less than TC, a simple Hartree-Fock-Bogliubov approximation was very good, I mean, at least in giving you sensible limiting answers and interpolating between them. And actually, there's a student of mine who's been working with Krishnamurti in understanding how dynamical mean field theory might include quantum fluctuations over and above the Bogliubov mean field theory for this crossover problem, but I can discuss that with some people later. Yeah, so there are of course quantitative corrections, you know, order parameters come down, spectral gaps come down. The only qualitative change is what you might expect, you know, spectral functions attain line widths when you go beyond Hartree-Fock, and greater than 3 delta you get incoherent spectral weight and so on. But the general features are, they just survive. There are only small quantitative changes.
So nobody's done multiple time.
I'll come to quantum. Well, actually, it's true that nobody has really done quantum Monte Carlo on this. This is correct. On this problem at low temperatures, maybe in the recent literature people have. Yeah, so Carlson and Pandri Pandey and so on, I think recently have done it. It's part of the literature I haven't followed. But I think they have done. But they have only looked at one point, I think. If I remember right, they looked at the point where AS basically diverges.
They have done more recent things.
They have done more recent things. Okay, fine. Okay, but
information that struck at this limit, I mean, they got the TC and spectrum.
Okay, so the saddle point approximation, unfortunately or fortunately, whatever you want to say, fails completely near TC. Okay, and that's the next point I want to describe. So you can certainly write down these equations near TC. So for you, for instance, one might say you want to determine TC, okay? So you just linearize the gap equation in the usual way and so on and so forth. And What you find actually is the following. So if you do a saddle point analysis for TC, and so I put it in quotes because it actually will turn out not to be the TC. So let me call it actually TC naught for whatever it's worth. So in the BCS limit, it's okay, which we know, okay, because BCS theory, everything works. But in the Bose limit, what you find is the following. Okay, what you find is that the gap equation, actually the role of the two equations changes. The gap equation used to determine delta, the number equation, the chemical potential. The gap equation now determines the chemical potential. And what you find is that the chemical potential is minus 1/2 the pair binding energy. So far, so good. But then you find that the number equation, that second equation down there, tells you that TC naught is some coefficient EB divided by the logarithm of EB divided by epsilon Fermi to the 2/3, or 3/2, I have it now. Yeah, something like that. Okay, so clearly what this is saying is that if I plot TC as a function of 1 over KFAS, it's minus infinity plus infinity, then this TC naught is just growing, okay? And then when you stare at this, you realize that this has nothing to do with phase coherence, but it has something to do with the formation of pairs. Because this is actually an equation which is very well known in the old plasma physics literature. It's called the Saha ionization equation, okay? That the dissociation temperature, the energy scale is set by the binding energy, but the entropy of broken pairs reduces it relative to the binding energy, and this log comes from that, okay? So this basically simply tells you that above this temperature, the system can essentially be described in terms of fermions. But below this temperature, it's dangerous to describe the system in terms of fermions. Because on this side, pairs form and immediately condense, but on this side, pairs only form, okay? So in order to go beyond that, you have to look at the next correction. So you do Gaussian fluctuations. So this is the pair formation temperature. Okay. So, okay, I'll omit the algebra. So you do Gaussian fluctuations, and what that does to you is it changes the thermodynamics completely, okay? Because the effective action now not only has the saddle point piece, it has more stuff in there. So it changes the thermodynamics, and it changes the number equation completely, which is very physical, because once the pairs form, the thermodynamics has to take them into account, which you weren't doing so, okay? So what you find then is that so this is some pair fluctuation propagator. So if you like to think diagrammatically, then basically gamma is the sum of ladders in the particle-particle channel. Okay, and so you're including terms of that kind in the thermodynamics, and you are changing your number equation effectively. And actually, the diagrammatics was done by Noziers and Schmidt-Rink in 1985. Okay, not precisely for this dilute gas model, but they had all the physical ideas there. Okay, and this makes a very tiny correction in the weak coupling limit, okay, which goes, it's subleading some power of TC over epsilon Fermi, which I couldn't try to reconstruct last night, but I knew once upon a time. But it turns out that in the bosonic limit, it looks extremely different, and you can understand why. Because this beast, instead of having just branch cut showing sort of incoherent, not incoherent, but what is the statement? Branch cut showing a continuum of excitations, it also has now a bound state pole at every Q, because that bound state pole is describing this boson, which is has a certain dispersion, right? So, and that is going to feed into the thermodynamics. And when you work through this, you find that the BCS limit answers are unchanged, but the Bose limit answers are drastically changed, so that mu at PC at this approximation is still minus 1/2 the pair binding energy. But TC now goes like the Bose density to the 2/3 divided by the mass of the boson. So actually it goes to, if you put in all the numbers, 0.218 of the Fermi energy. Okay? So this then brings me to this picture. And you can see that this is the T naught that you got from the saddle point level at which the pairs form. And this is what you get for where the pairs condense. So now, and it smoothly interpolates between these. Now you can say that, look, I did a saddle point calculation, I got that. I did Gaussian fluctuations, I got a tiny change here, but I got an infinitely large change here. So why should I trust this answer? Yes? So you can go to the next correction. And at least for the static 5/4 corrections, meaning spatial dependencies kept, you can easily convince yourself that that's not going to do very much in this regime. Okay, and why is that? That's something you know from critical phenomena, because the Ginzburg regime here is TC over epsilon Fermi to the 4th power in 3 dimensions clean. Okay. But here too, as I said, the correlation length is large because of the diluteness criterion. So critical phenomena are restricted to a rather small range of reduced temperatures in a dilute Bose gas. So you can work out based on this that the critical region sort of is exponentially small, broadens out to something of order unity in between, based on the fact that I told you C naught was of order interparticle spacing. And then, again, falls off in a power law fashion. Okay, so precisely around here, you are in a rather murky regime. Okay, where you could say that the large change caused by going from saddle point to Gaussian, maybe if you go beyond it, you might get something significant.
I mean, the real problem is, I guess, that the extent of, and when I say quantum critical, right, there's also a time axis.
Yes.
So actually, the extent of the
right. So actually, we have results on the time story also. So the time story also, we have lots of results in this. Okay. So in if you look at the dynamics of the sort of order parameter field, this pair field, then it's basically diffusive out here in the BCS limit, because as soon as you create a pair about TC, it decays into the particle continuum. Okay. Whereas out here, if you create a pair, it propagates forever, okay, once you're outside of the critical regime at least. Okay, so you can see exactly how the dynamics evolves from one to the other. And I'm just not going through some of those details, but you're welcome to look at there. Okay, so now in the remaining 10 minutes, let me try to spend at least 5 minutes each on some things different. So probably
well,
this.
Oh, I think I might have given you the wrong impression. We have this room is reserved until 12 o'clock. And
Okay, so attrition is when people start leaving, then I stop.
Well, we always have a break now, at some stage.
Okay, so now what I want to do is I want to discuss 2 dimensions. Yeah.
I think Chris has a good idea. And so just give you more time, give the audience more time. So let me just pause it, invite some questions. from the audience.
Okay, sure.
And in case of questions and then or comments, and then we may convince, let's say, rest for 2 minutes, and then we convince, because I think the other part are very interesting, and then a lot of people want to hear.
But it won't take so much time. But yeah, sure, we can break.
I think Chris is usually pretty wise about giving people, making things efficient. I think every 2 minutes. So may I open the floor for questions? Any questions?
Why is there a minimum in the coherence length?
Okay, actually, if you were, if that's because you have a dilute gas. Suppose it didn't have a dilute gas, okay, you could certainly arrange for some model in which that didn't happen. I would expect that the coherence length would be very large in the BCS limit as usual, and then it would just saturate to the interparticle spacing as you went to the strong attraction limit. But here it turns out that the Bose gas is dilute, so it doesn't saturate, it actually again starts building up slowly. So it's the diluteness of the Bose gas which is leading to that buildup.
So are you going to say a little bit about quantum Monte Carlo?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
Yes. So the two topics I want to discuss next are some analytical results on the 2D continuum model, and then a brief review of a couple of papers on the quantum Monte Carlo for two dimensions.
On 2D or 3D?
2D. So everything that remains is 2D.
Fine. Yes. Other question, Mike?
Can I just return to this issue about the single particle excitation?
Yes.
In the dilute limit. If the scattering becomes strong, the interparticle potential becomes strong, does one ever have to worry about three-body effects? In other words, how the extra fermion scatters off?
I understand. Okay, so in the continuum model, we certainly have not worried about that.
Yes.
In some lattice models, you can sort of show that this is not an issue. Okay?
As long as you only have one state per side. Yeah.
Yeah. This is right.
Yeah, sure.
So, like if you take something like the attractive Hubbard model, about which I'm going to tell you something later on, there you can see that this is not an issue. But you're right. I mean, if you really crank up an attractive interaction, I mean, why stop at two-body bound states? You could even have more complicated things happening, I suppose.
I guess another thing which isn't really an issue in the condensed matter case because of charge neutrality, but here it might be a slight issue, is overall instability.
Yes.
You mean the whole thing
collapse? Because 3D and 2D are kind of different.
Again, I would say that in some lattice models, even with neutral fermions, you can make sure that there are no gas liquid instabilities and so on and so forth.
But you might think that they could be that. I mean, if you think like helium-4, of course, one does have a lattice.
No, I'm saying, yes, agreed. But I'm saying there are some specific lattice models of fermions which show the BCS-BEC crossover where you can really address this issue and say that it's not an issue. But I don't think I can make any general statements.
But I think this question collapse also depends on how many grams of fermion you have.
Oh, sure.
I mean, by looking at neutron matter compared with symmetric nuclear matter, well, the evidence seems to be that neutrons will not undergo a liquid gas or a transition, whereas symmetric nuclear matter will.
Yeah, so it matters.
So it will be.
Yeah, actually, I've been looking for a simple explanation of why the number of fermion species increases and suddenly there's a critical number and they collapse, the whole thing collapses. There are generalization of these models with just n species, and then at some point, then the whole thing rejections, the whole thing collapses if the number of species sufficiently large. I mean, I'm just looking for a simple explanation of it. But It's just a comment. I think at the moment there is a controversy from experimentalists and some theories about the nature of these states, and there are even proposals saying that the conventional causal picture may not be applicable in the current experiment of freshman resonance, and I think it's a big thing of dispute. And I think various of us have different opinions, and I think this, and I think we'll be continue to discuss during the conference and in the course of this workshop. So there are various kinds of models now being proposed, and then there are very, I think there are generalization of these to such studies to those models, and then there was question about what's the nature of the phase.
Right.
And so
there is a dispute, actually. I mean, the arguments are so crystal clear and simple, right? It's all about symmetry. So when you start out in the decoupling limit, you have the same vacuum as you have it in the slow coupling limit. How can you have anything, you know, really, any real qualitative change happening in between?
I'm not a proponent of those theory, but let me just paraphrase them, and they would say that, well, we have a, in their opinion, we have a really different kind of system, not just a potential. I'm doing just change, pulling the well down, and they say that, well, we have a really a boson, which actually made up of different spin states than the fermions. So therefore,
these were symmetry states, actually.
And they claim that there would be, well, the question is really, there's an order parameter, what is the nature of the order parameter? And at the heart of it, that's that T over zero is there, is there not a quantum phase transition? And then the, I mean, how many classes of crossover or transition that you have? So, how much longer do you give? I don't know. In the next few weeks, we may have some of those discussions.
So, Mike, the answer to your question is yes, it just becomes completely particle like.
Could you comment on the role of background fermions on a bound molecule?
Yes. And can I just do the 2D and then comment on that? Because it'll be, I did want to say something on that. So I will return to that question. I have one, two, well, it's okay, whatever. If people want to break, that's fine.
How much time do you think? 5 to 10 minutes?
It depends a little bit. It'll probably, I think if we do it slowly, it'll take 15 minutes, realistically.
Well, I don't want you to rush, but I think the what you're going to tell us will probably be very interesting. There might be a lot of questions.
So, okay.
And then we have the room itself at 2
sure.
o'clock. So may I suggest it's 2 minutes, and please come back in sharp.
Don't rush, please.
Again, broken pick of honors, to say that the way it comes to the reason that the fluctuation is high. But now, how do you make, I mean, how do you conclude that
So from this we have estimated the pressure.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Sorry, it was not hand waving. It sounded like hand waving.
Oh, I see.
I just didn't want to put down horrible formulas.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
The three bonus law. I mean, going to the studied limit again and imagining the extra fermions.
Yes.
The immense phase you had at one extra fermion. You might have thought that there'd be some characteristic behavior to do with the whatever phase shift zero energy of that thing scattering the peer would be.
When the number. I'm going to make it much smaller.
Whether you get any normalizations or not, because I think from your diagram with when I asked you about the top line, it's sort of implied in the limit that the thing becomes very very mass. That's not been normalized, is that correct?
Yes, it does imply that. The same gradient. This is correct. It implies that, and now let us see.
And I'm just wondering, you're thinking almost in a rather intuitive way, but you've got this thing being scattered perhaps rather coherently from this assembly.
I think the point is the following, that the condensate tightly bound pairs set some energy.
Yes.
And these extra fermions you're putting on it are gigantic.
Yes.
That's why they just look free, you know.
So you think the scattering phase shift will be...
The kinetic energy is so much larger than any other thing in the problem.
Doesn't it start with like a brick wall? It's more like thermometric scattering
or something.
Okay, so now actually, to be honest, I have never calculated the scattering of the embedded particles of the condensate.
No, I understand. It's
beyond.
It's way beyond.
Sure,
yeah.
Okay.
But I guess what I was wondering was whether there's a correction for that. Yeah. So I think there's a correction for the expanding of the thing as a function of the play, maybe. So you have like a correction for this could be related to
from here to
follow. So it's somehow one of the mass gases
that's worked away from like a human scattering.
I understand. That's why it's absent in this.
Yes.
So if you're going down Hollister, do you know Magnolia Shopping Center? It's actually
435. It's actually the road that's
Download every paper, and I didn't even have access to the green book. It was in the pre-con map.
Are you going to give a talk in the other?
Yes. That's the next question. I don't want to set up impose from it.
No, on the contrary, you just have around that. Some more technical issues about
it. I need to get something big.
I don't know whether you know if they answered it.
This 2D is very different, as I would say. It's very germane to the question raised by what is the role of the standard fermion?
Oh, sorry.
So I just wanted to ask you a quick question.
Sure.
Since this work is summarized,
actually, there are a ton of you are.
I can see the meeting when I was young.
So probably 10 more years when you've known such meetings.
I haven't really said that this past time. I don't know.
Thank you.
I think I'll be able to sit down.
Too much air. Should I cut down the air supply on the other side?
Yeah, here's what I saw.
Too much air.
Do you think the robots have to change the symmetry for a transition? Because aren't there counter examples where I've seen it? Weak phase transition series, I think.
Probably a few other examples.
But there's no phase separation. Is there any phase separation?
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we are going to start again.
And I would say that we need to find situations.
Okay, so actually somebody asked me during the break to give him references and reviews. So I put them down. One of them is in the Green Book, which I couldn't lay my hands on here, but I think the BEC community knows this book well, Griffin, Snow, and Svengari. And another one is in a set of Varana lectures. There was a 97, it's edited by Ayodhanisi and Shrifa. This was on mainly on superconductivity, but it's easier to pull it up, quant map, so I put it down there. Okay, so now I want to talk about two dimensions. So two dimensions is actually a very interesting thing. Because if you look at the T matrix, okay, then it turns out you can't take the E going to zero limit off the top, I mean immediately. Because, again, I'm doing a dilute gas approximation. So those of you who know this in 3D know that there's a Q cotangent delta Q. This E is this Q squared. But here there's no additional Q. It's different. And the other thing is, you see, scattering lengths come about because scattering cross sections in three dimensions have the units of area. But you can't define a scattering length in two dimensions. Okay, because cross sections don't have units of area. And it turns out that this cotangent of this phase shift in two dimensions is given by the following. So instead of the scattering length, there is a new parameter, which I call EA, let's say. So again, I'm making this approximation. So this replaces the scattering length. And so there's this one parameter with units of energy which correctly characterizes low energy scattering in two dimensions. And what is the physical meaning of this? So again, let's look at a potential V of R with attraction V naught. And what you'll find is when EA, this parameter, measured in units of the natural parameter h bar over mr squared is of order 1, diverges, and then rises with an essential singularity. Okay? And so this, the x axis is the attraction, and there's only a single scale, which let us call V2. So if there were no attraction, then there's only one energy scale in the problem, h bar squared over mr squared. So that certainly, this EA has to be that. Correct? But now as I crank up the attraction, this scale EA rises, and in this entire region, there's no two-body bound state in vacuum. Because you can see it's essentially a repulsive potential. But once I cross a certain threshold, this is the two-body bound state threshold. And above that threshold, the physical meaning of this parameter EA is the binding energy. course, it doesn't have that interpretation down there. Okay. So one thing that you see immediately from this picture is that there seems to be only one threshold, okay, which is a little bit different from what happened in three dimensions, where there were two thresholds, one for the threshold to have a many-body pairing instability and a threshold to form a two-body bound state. Here, not so. Okay. So again, if one looks at the phase shift in this region, then one finds that the phase shift at all energies is negative, so it's repulsive. And here, what we find is that the phase shift at zero energy by Levinson's theorem is pi, and the phase shift at finite energy is still positive. Okay? So basically, there seems to be a close connection between the sign of the phase shift at finite energies to the sign of the phase shift at zero energies. Okay? And so from this, what you can show is that in 2D, in two-body bound state in vacuum, with a dilute gas is a necessary and sufficient condition for the BCS instability in the many-body problem. First thing is, you might think this is an entirely trivial result, because you say, well, if I have an attractive potential in two dimensions, I'll always form a two-body bound state in vacuum. True, but if I have a hard core, or more generally, if integral d to r d of r is positive, in the hard core case it's actually infinity, then it turns out there is a finite threshold, non-zero threshold. And the statement here is that you have to cross exactly the same threshold in order to get the BCS instability. Okay? And this is only true, even in two dimensions, for L equals 0, not for higher angular moments. You can show that as well. Okay?
What happened in higher momentum? You have two.
There are different
scales.
That's right. The sign of the phase shift at zero energy is not correlated uniquely with the sign of the phase shift at finite energy. Okay. And to give you some feeling for why all of this is happening, it's really very much because of this log. In higher channels, there are the singularities here have pole structure as well. Here it's just a log. Okay. And where does this log come from? This log comes from the fact that in two dimensions, okay, whether you're in a lattice or a continuum, at the bottom of the band, you always have a jump discontinuity in the density of states. Okay, unlike in three, where you just have a square and similarity. And that jump discontinuity, of course, is in the imaginary part of the Green's function, and it's Cramer's Cramming in the real part turns out to be a log, and it feeds in through the T matrix here, and so on. Okay. Another way to think about it is, you know, in higher dimensions, I'm drawing the density of states versus energy, you can have finite density of states here, but by the time you've gone down here, you've lost it. So even though you get a Cooper instability here, you lose it by the time you're here. Not so anyway. That's a sort of trivial way to remember.
And you couldn't be related also to just the behavior of the two-body thing at zero energy with no potential and having a logarithmic solution as well as a constant.
Yes, this is correct. So, you know. I think it's closely tied to that. Actually, okay, while we are on this subject, maybe one other interesting fact which has nothing to do with BCS, BEC, and so on, but suppose I have repulsive potentials, okay, and I play this game. So for instance, if you do a dilute gas expansion like Galitsky did for three-dimensional repulsive fermions, then the small parameter turns out to be Na cubed, where N is the density and A is the hard core radius. It turns out because of this log, the corresponding expansion parameter for 2D repulsive fermions is not Na squared. It's rather 1 over the logarithm of 1 over Na squared. Okay, so there are these laws keep appearing when you study dilute gases in two dimensions. Okay, the other point back to BCS PEC is that if you this much space is enough. So if you want to study the t equals 0, t equals 2, BCS, BUC crossover, then it turns out that the Hartree-Fock-Bogliova mean field equations, you get the gap equation, you get a number equation, this can be solved analytically for all values of the coupling constant, which you cannot do usually in these kinds of problems. Okay? And so you get a very simple at t equals 0. And the answer I can just write down after a lot of algebra, the answer is this. Okay. So it's a really very simple answer. I think you can hear it. Yeah. So, so you might say, where is the BCS essential singularity hidden? It's hidden here in the A.
It's not for hearing, it's for recording the talk on the web.
Oh, okay. So I should have said all the nasty things while I was not ready. That's for the other workshop. This is a workshop with nice people, right?
You will be invited back again.
Okay, so the essential singularity of BCS is hidden in there, because you see somewhere here you had an essential singularity, okay? And then you can see that, you know, when this is very small, the chemical potential is the Fermi energy. When this dominates over that, it's 1/2 the pair binding. And it's just a completely trivial, and you can calculate all kinds of things analytically for this two-dimensional problem. Okay, at all values of the coupling constant, all the way from BCS to Bose-Einstein. So it's kind of nice thing, actually, to just be able to calculate everything. Yes, now I should come to your question. Yes, another question, yes.
So now you have a gap obtained from Hartree-Fock-Bogliova.
Yes.
However, the Hartree-Fock-Bogliova is variational, so it tends to favor the order phase.
Yes.
So is there any other argument that we can believe that the gap is real?
Okay, so insofar as Hartree-Fock-Bogliova, the only thing we can say is that it's, we know it's okay in the BCS limit, we know it's okay in the Bose limit, and in between is just variational. As I said, for lattice models, there is some recent work of a student of mine, Aarti Garg, done with H.R. Krishnamurti in Bangalore, where they have looked at dynamical mean field theory, which is a way to include local quantum fluctuations over and above Hartree-Fock-Bogliova. And indeed, one finds that Hartree-Fock overestimates gaps, overestimates order parameters, gives absolutely sharp spectral functions, and so on. So when you do those fluctuations, you get some changes there. But I don't think anything qualitatively changes.
But
there
still is a gap.
There still is a gap. Yeah. Okay. Good. So one thing that I wanted to say here, and I think this is goes back to your earlier question, is that just because I form two-body bound states in vacuum doesn't mean that in the many-body problem I'm going to be in a Bose-Einstein condensate limit. Okay? Because in two dimensions, you're always, if that were your criterion, you would always be in the Bose-Einstein condensation limit. You're not. Because even though you form two-body bound state in vacuum, they are, nevertheless, the chemical potential in the weak attraction limit is very large. You are not in a Bose-Einstein condensate. You are much more in a BCS regime, where the momentum distribution is only slightly rounded on the scale of, EF. Okay?
So information about the size of the pair.
Yes. So there are these, I can give you references. Even that's all analytically, you can work out the size of the pairs in 2D and everything, yes.
Okay.
So the crossover when the pair size is small compared to the particle separation?
Yes, so actually the crossover is of course a crossover, but when the chemical potential goes below the bottom of the band, the Fermi degeneracy of the system is lost, and the size of the pairs becomes of order the interparticle spacing. All of these are the correct criterion for the crossover region. Okay, so I think this perhaps answers your question, because you see, when you have a Fermi surface, the fact that you can form a bound state in vacuum is not particularly important, right? Because Pauli exclusion blocks that kind of stuff, and it's only a instability of the Fermi C which is important. But as the attraction gets larger and larger, you're undoing the Fermi C, and then you can make these real molecules, if you wish, and this is somehow trying to treat the crossover.
So, well, according to recent experiments,
yes,
bosons or from
okay, so I think I would like to make a clear distinction between the model that I'm describing and the experiments, because the experiments might well be described by some different Hamiltonian.
Well, you're talking about two dimensions here. You haven't had any two-dimensional experiments yet.
No, that's true, but
the,
what, maybe...
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
So let's see. So the next thing that one would like to study is finite temperature two dimensions. Okay. Now here, the kind of functional integral that I had used and so on becomes less useful, because as we know, there are very strong phase fluctuations and so on that one needs to, thermal fluctuations that one needs to worry about in two dimensions. Okay, and you get a costless, Thouless transition and so on and so forth. So because of the ease of formation of bound states at finite center of mass momentum, as described there, and because of the importance of thermal fluctuations, you might expect that this regime, where the transition temperature is much larger than the formation or crossover scale, okay, persists down to rather weak coupling. Not to infinitely weak coupling, but to weaker couplings or weaker attractions than in 3D. Okay? And so you would really like to study this regime. So, let's see, where am I? So for this purpose, actually, we've done, or we did many, many years ago, rather extensive studies of the attractive Hubbard model. And I'll tell you why. Okay, so this is the simplest model of lattice fermions in two dimensions, which, because you've explicitly turned on an attraction, will give you an S-wave superconducting ground state, provided you're away from half-filling. At half-filling, some other orders like charge density waves also exist, coexist. Okay, so from various arguments and calculations, the following phase diagram is known. Okay, so as you can imagine, this is to be taken just as a free hand drawing, okay? I mean, actually, this will come down with an essential singularity. This is something like TC0. So TC0 is growing as I crank up traction. TC itself, unlike in the continuum problem where it's saturated to the BEC value, actually falls down, okay? Why does it fall down? Because over here, of course, it's BCS theory. So TC goes like T exponential minus number T over mod U. But over here, TC goes like T square over mod U. And the reason for this is actually rather easy to see. If I'm in very strong coupling, the strongest energy scale is U, so I will form tightly bound bosons at a given site. And the Hopping matrix element of these, which is the inverse Bose mass within second order perturbation theory, will be T squared over U. So the bosons are getting heavier as you go in this direction, and which is why you get this result. So now the question, yes?
Is there more a lattice effect?
Yes.
It's not the dimensionality effect.
Yes, so correct. This is a lattice effect which is true in any dimensions. Okay, you get a hardcore Bose gas whose Hopping matrix element is dying on you, which is why you get this. The dimensionality effect is that this curve is probably going to be, you know, up here in higher dimensions and is pushed down in lower dimensions because of thermal fluctuations and ease of formation of bound states. And now the question is the following. So here I have a superconductor or a superfluid, and here I have a Fermi liquid. Because I heat the superconductor, break the pairs. Here, I have a condensed Bose liquid. I heat the system, and I go into a normal Bose system. And now the question is, suppose I go take a path, which I will draw in pink. Okay, how do the correlation functions of the system evolve from a Fermi liquid to a Bose liquid? I'm not crossing any phase transition, okay? This question could have a boring answer. The boring answer could have been that this path always takes me to such high temperatures that quantum statistics is useless, okay? But it turns out that in two dimensions, it doesn't have a boring answer. It has a very interesting answer. And so we would like to characterize the physics of this region.
Well, the same is in
three dimensions, this region may push you a little bit more towards non-degenerate regimes.
If one leaves turn experiments, then because in the normal state, one can cross over also in the degenerate regimes.
Okay, fine. That's a quantitative matter, I agree. But in principle, yes. Okay, it's just a larger temperature regime in two dimensions, that's all. Also, the method we used to attack this was so developed right here, okay?
What's the scale of this pump that
excuse me. Well, excuse me. It's just of order unity, I suppose. Both of these are of order unity. There's no other no other scale in the problem. Excuse me. So what we did was use quantum Monte Carlo, and these are actually Santa Barbara algorithms developed by Blankenbechler, Sugar, and Scalapino, and then used a lot. Excuse me. By Scalapino and co-workers for condensed matter physics. Now, this problem is ideally suited for numerics and perhaps should be revisited now that computational power is much better than what it was 10, 15 years ago when we did this problem. Why is it ideally suited for numerics? First of all, I want to address an intermediate coupling question. Computers like numbers of order unity rather than, you know, one this or that. Here the correlation lengths are very large. They don't fit onto your finite lattices. Here the Trotter errors are very large. Secondly, I'm interested in inherently finite temperature method. These finite temperature quantum Monte Carlo algorithms have trouble sometimes going through phase transitions and so on. I'm not interested in the phase transition. Okay? And thirdly, and most importantly, for the negative U-Hubbard model, there's no sign problem. Thank you, Jason. And this was shown by Jorge Hirsch in 1983.
So it's not necessarily the case in the continuum. I would have an intuition saying that you know, always when you have a superfluid ground state, you should always consider the size. That might be.
Actually, I wish I had time to go into why there's no sign problem. It has nothing to do with superconductivity. I don't have physical insight. So for instance, okay, how does this, again, this says you put the fermions in a lattice, do a coherent state path integral, do a Hubbard-Stratonovich decoupling, integrate out the fermions so that you only deal with bosonic variables. Now, any theorist would have told you, or one who's used to doing analytical work, the nice decoupling to use is the Psi-Dagger decoupling, because you're dealing with this. Not. If you do that, there's a sign problem. Okay? But if you do a decoupling in the charge, so C-Dagger-C decoupling, okay, there's no sign problem. That would be a disastrous thing to do if you wanted to do saddle point plus fluctuations. But if you want to put it on a computer, it's okay, you know? Any decoupling is fine.
Don't you need to use Grassmann variables?
Yes, and then I integrate out the Grassmann variables, and then I get determinants, and the determinants, I get an upspin determinant and a downspin determinant. For the negative U-Hubbard model for the charge decoupling, those determinants are identical, so I get the square of a determinant, and I'm home. Okay? You can't do that for the repulsive Hubbard model. If you try to do that, you get complex weights and so on. Okay, for the charge decoupling. So there people use the spin decoupling. Then you get real weights, but you get a sign problem.
This is not restricted to two dimensions, right?
This is not restricted to two dimensions. Of course, computer power is restricted to two dimensions.
Yeah, I think Jeff, you know, I think they're not aware of this development. I think they're seeing it now.
Okay.
So when you do these calculations in the computer, I mean, people are doing that. They are terrorized by sign problems, or they also have a way around it?
Okay, so people who are doing it in the continuum, they have sign problems. They show up in probably different ways, because in the continuum, they're not doing coherent state path integrals. So either they are doing, like I think Joe Carlson and others, they are doing some kind of Green's function Monte Carlo at zero temperature. Then the sign problem shows up in fixed node versus release node stories. Okay? Or I think David Sepperly is also, and Nandini Trivedi, they are also working on this. But there they use these world line, sort of this sort of real Feynman path integrals, not world line, but you know. And there I think you have sign problems in terms of permutations. You have to keep permute. So there are sign problems.
Because I say, I think currently there is an effort to do that at the UK, the National Institute of UK Studies, that was happening with my. I think they might even have a paper, but it seems that they were aware of the activity and discovering things like this.
Okay, so.
This is one of the collaborations of people who are real experts on the Monte Carlo, like Nandini Trivedi, Adriana Morio, Richard Scala. So first I want to show you the chemical potential as a function of temperature. Thank you very much.
Where is the microphone? Did I just simply lose it? Well, so much for that. There are no experimentalists in the audience to help
me.
No,
we have nice people. We lost it, so that's fine.
Okay, so this chemical potential is a function of temperature. And this is at various values. This is a non-interacting system, U of minus 4, 8, 12, so on and so forth. And what you find, contrary to some early expectations based on analytic work, which said that d mu dt was not negative, and I think it was just wrong, we find that the chemical potential always decreases with temperature. And then this dashed line tells you that this is the regime where the system is degenerate. So what have I done? I've looked at the chemical potential, I've put in the Hartree shift, the bottom of the band is at minus 4, and I've said that when this thing is greater than T, much greater than T, for instance, then the system is degenerate. Otherwise, the chemical potential corrected for the Hartree shift has gone below the bottom of the band, then and non-degenerate. Okay, so at high temperatures and strong coupling, I'm non-degenerate Fermi system. over here I'm degenerate. And one clear way to see that I'm degenerate is I can just calculate the momentum distribution. That time the biggest we could go was 16 by 16, but now I'm sure people can do much bigger. Okay, and you can see it looks very degenerate, right? So it's a degenerate normal Fermi system. Now, how do I know it's normal? Well, I haven't shown you that really, but there was this work of Scalapino and Murillo where they estimated TC at U equals 4, and TC is somewhere down here. And so there's this entire region where I'm above TC. Okay, but I can also calculate the pair-pair correlation function and check that it's short-ranged and so on and so forth. So we know.
What were the earlier speculation that the mu dt is possible?
See, actually, d mu dt, there's no thermodynamic reason. It's not an inequality that thermodynamics mandates, it turns out. But it's very, I mean, it's not very common for d mu dt, certainly. Most systems I know, certainly, d mu dt does this. Why did, because I think, okay, we can discuss that paper. I don't want to badmouth the authors of that paper, but they made very tall claims. They who shall remain nameless.
Dt is minus entropy.
No, okay.
Like ESDN.
So now, let's see what the properties of the system are. So here is spin susceptibility as a function of temperature. And in the non-interacting system, what you find is, okay, at large temperatures, you get a Curie tail, and at low temperatures, you get a Pauli susceptibility, which is flat. This little hump is due to some Van Hove singularity effects and so on and so forth. And what we find in the attractive Hubbard model normal state is that you get very large regions in which d chi dt is positive. Okay, so that's kind of surprising, because usually you're used to Curie or Pauli. But in a state which is a normal Fermi system, you're not used to d chi dt being positive. And you can see it's always like that. It's basically singlet formation in the normal state. And so in order to get susceptibility, you have to break the singlet, which is why the susceptibility increases as a function of temperature. Okay, and this can be seen very much more clearly and significantly in a measurement of 1 over T1T, which may be a very unfamiliar object to people in this workshop. So this is something called the NMR relaxation rate, which NMR people in the solid state actually measure a lot. And let me try to motivate what the
Normal light, but this is a yes, exactly. So why do you call it normal
from liquid? So I didn't. I put normal in big quotation marks. I mean, that was the whole point of the exercise, right? So what is 1 over T1T? See, basically, you are asking for flipping a nuclear spin. And as it flips, it dumps that energy into the particle hole continuum, OK? Since NMR is a local probe, I'm summing over all Q, the dynamic susceptibility for spin flips Q and omega. Since the nuclear Zeeman energy is tiny on electronic scales, I take this omega going to zero limit. Okay, so this really is measuring the spectral density for making singlet to triplet excitations in my system. And in a normal Fermi liquid, this is very famous Coringa law that 1 over T1T is constant. Okay, it's like 1 over T1 scales like temperature. The phase space for making spin flips is scaling linearly with temperature, like specific heat and so on and so forth. And spin susceptibility is constant. And in fact, 1 over T1T goes like the spin susceptibility squared. This is called the Coringa. Okay, but here you find that again, by directly probing the dynamic susceptibility, okay, how we calculated it, I'll discuss. I can discuss with the Monte Carlo people. Okay, but you can see that again, as I'm cooling down in this normal system, the spectral weight density for making singlet to triplet excitations is dying on me. And if I plot a parametric plot of 1 over T1T versus chi spin, then of course in a Fermi liquid, all of this data should have collapsed to a single point. Here you find that 1 over T1T tracks the spin susceptibility. Now, the significance of this was despite that this is a toy model, actually all of these phenomena are seen in the pseudo gap of high TC superconductors. That's a problem which has all kinds of other complications that I don't want to get into at all, okay? Because this is just a toy model. This is no Mott physics, no strong correlations of that sort. But what it says is that I'm looking at the normal state of a short coherence length superconductor, and I'm immediately getting a very strange physics out, which I'm not used to seeing. Okay? So again, as Jason said, is this really a normal Fermi liquid? Not, because we could also calculate the density of states at the chemical potential as a function of temperature, again using tricks that I'd be happy to describe because these are dynamical quantities. And that's shown as the black triangles, and the boxes are the spin susceptibility. And what you find is that in this normal state, both of these quantities track each other and fall dramatically. So this is what is called a pseudo gap, because there's a spin gap in the spin spectrum that I was telling you. And now I'm showing you that the spin susceptibility tracks the density of states of the chemical potential, and that's also falling on you as you're going down to low temperatures in this normal state. Okay? So this, on the face of it, looks very Fermi liquid-like, except both of them are strongly temperature-dependent. And then the next thing to ask is, what does the charge channel do? Okay, this is the spin channel. And the charge channel shows that dN dμ is very flat as a function of temperature. Okay, so while in the spin channel you see dramatic changes, in the charge channel you see very little. And we understand that, because even if you look at, see, it's heading to be a superconductor. In the superconductor, the spin susceptibility, the density of states, everything is going to go to zero at zero temperature. But in a superconductor, the compressibility is definitely not heading to zero, okay? It's a finite compressibility, because it's governed by the collective excitations in this neutral system. And in fact, if you do a very naive Bogliubov Hartree-Fock theory at zero temperature, you get an answer which is not too much off at the zero temperature limit for this range of things, okay? So I think that's probably about all that I wanted to say.
Can you sketch the density of states? Do you have that information?
No, we don't have that information, because that would require full analytic continuation for what the density of states does. So we only had information about the density of states at the chemical potential. But so basically what we found was that there are indeed violations of Fermi liquid theory as you go from a Fermi system to a Bose system. They are happening in a highly degenerate Fermi system. Okay?
So what's the scale of what violations on this?
Okay. So at U of 4, where we had lots of results, we had some at 8 and higher also. Okay, this temperature, so this is not drawn to scale, from the estimates was this, or at least 0.1 T. This is actually hard to do, because you know, this is a costless-Thouless phase transition. If you do finite size scaling, the correlation length is growing exponentially on you, and so on and so forth. Okay, so there are, I think, large uncertainties in this TC estimate here. There are less uncertainties here, and this is a for the T in this model. Okay, so there is at least a order of magnitude where you see this. So I suppose, in a sense, this is a little different from the way people usually want to think of some non-Fermi liquid phase and then view superconductivity as an instability from it. I'm sort of inverting the question. I'm saying, suppose I know that the ground state is a superconductor and I heat it. Do I necessarily go into a Fermi liquid? The answer is yes in the weak coupling limit. But as I move away to the intermediate coupling limit, the answer is no. Okay, I begin to see deviations, rather striking ones, away from Fermi liquid behavior. And of course, we know that the answer is a definite no here. You go into a Bose liquid. Okay, so I think I took much more time than I had planned, but thank you very much.